raining. It's pouring. This old town is boring. Not so. Slip into something waterproof. Step outside. One step closer to the vanishing point.
August 25th, afternoon, my living room. The day began in a watery fashion, similar to that of the past 3 weeks.
The weather for the inland coastal area is, in a word, wet.
I woke with a numb sensation shooting through my upper arms, my ears filled with the sound of hard rain striking wet pavement. I sat on the edge of my bed and rubbed at the blurred margins of my consciousness. Eventually, I gathered myself together sufficiently to phone a reminder into work that I'd be coming in late. I then called my physician's receptionist to confirm my early appointment. In the silence of a morning broken only by the soft, insistent hissing of rain, I had breakfast from a box, showered, dressed warmly against the weather, and left for the doctor's office. The reception area at the doctor's was a small, dimly lit affair. I sat in a chair that sagged and stared at the one well-lit corner of the room. In a fishbowl on a table set beneath a pale yellow globe of electric light, neon tetras and fancy guppies flashed in and about ferns and plaster castles, playing whatever games it is that guppies and tetras play. Sleek and glittering in their iridescent wetsuits, they sped effortlessly around their tiny world, living the life that only guppies and tetras know how to live. Eating, sleeping, mating, procreating, devouring their brood and beginning all over again. Around and around and around.
Mr. Danforth?
Yes.
The doctor will see you now.
Normally, I would have been examined by Dr. Joe Jr., but he was away on holidays. And in any case, Dr. Joe Sr. was in every way like his son, only older. Hello.
Shirt off.
Like so many physicians of his generation, he preferred a tactile approach when examining. I told him of the continuing numbness in my arms, and he kneaded my biceps and triceps like bread dough. I mentioned the shortness of breath I was experiencing, and he thumped me firmly on the chest. He ran a hand down either side of my throat, then along my shoulder blades, at which time he muttered something about myotomas. After still more kneading and mumbling, he began scribbling on a notepad.
Your skin been bothering you?
Yes, it has. It's been itching. I hadn't mentioned it because it didn't seem important.
There.
He thrust a piece of paper into my hands. As I read what he'd written, I felt my pulse quicken.
Oh, I see.
It said I was to take cool baths and wherever possible keep my skin wetted.
What is it that I'm suffering from exactly?
It seems...
he replied, pushing his glasses further up on his face.
Fish. I suspect,
he added vaguely as he disappeared out the door.
Salmon or trout of some sort.
August 26th, late morning. The office. Up until now, my life has been a dull one. I'm not complaining. My parents were orderly people, and I am, in all respects, my parents' son. It should come as no surprise, then, that I was more than a little taken aback by Dr. Joe Sr.'s strange behavior yesterday. It's clear to me now that he's quite deranged, and that I shall have to await Dr. Joe Jr.'s arrival to discover what it is that really ails me, and expose to him the fullness of his father's incapacity. I confess I had, for an instant yesterday, wondered about the truth of Dr. Joe Sr.'s prognosis. I rejected it almost immediately, of course, but for a moment I speculated upon what it would be like to turn into a fish. Almost certainly horrible, I would imagine. I've never liked fish, not the smell, not to eat, not to raise, and certainly not as friends and peers.
Hard at work, Charles?
Oh, it's you.
As I am sole accountant for our radio station, indeed the entire accounting department, I have a section all to myself and a desk which faces the window. Because of this awkward positioning, if one is not on one's guard and keeping a weather eye out for reflections in the window, it can prove most unsettling. It was Anna, from newscasting, who had crept up behind me and was staring intently beyond my shoulders at the rain.
Horrible weather, isn't it?
Oh, it's awful. And no sign of letting up.
Oh, well. You should be happy.
Me?
Her comment surprised me. I'm not known around the office as one of the most jovial.
Why?
If it keeps up like this, The baseball game will be canceled at Mr. Purcell's.
I had forgotten entirely. Mr. Purcell is our station manager, and every year at this time he throws a staff party at his home, the heart and soul of which is the baseball game played in the field out back. I'm a terrible player, and inevitably end up in the far outfield studying grass and sky.
There's a silver lining in those gray clouds after all, eh, Charles?
I worked doubly hard to recoup the losses my absence yesterday had created, but the rain continued to beat down harder than ever, and my arms and shoulders seemed at times to be carved from ice. My legs as well, a little. Stupid doctor. August 27th, late at night, my bedroom. It's time for me to recognize the truly enormous powers of suggestion. Since my encounter with Dr. Joe Sr., I find that I'm inordinately concerned with, no, not just concerned with, obsessed with all things of a fish-like nature. I have this evening awoken from a dream in which I was engaged in an activity, the word for which escapes me presently. There were hundreds, thousands of us, crawling and wriggling on our bellies in the middle of a water-slick street, progressing when the light shone green, stopping when the light shone red, wriggling from one lane to the next, wriggling all in the same direction, our hands flapping, our feet waving back and forth. I awoke and immediately consulted my dictionary and discovered the word myotomus, which Dr. Joe Sr. had used during my examination, refers to the muscles on a fish's back governing the lateral fins. I am desolate, diary. Completely, utterly desolate. Oh, yes. Spawning. The word for the activity in which we were engaged in my dream was spawning. Three in the morning, August 30th, my bedroom. The party at Mr. Purcell's was populated by a generation I was born with, yet have never somehow become part of. The good-looking generation. A group who remain dry, whatever the temperature, whose teeth are bright and straight, whose handshakes and clothing immaculate, and breath never bad. Through them all I wandered, drink in hand, like a pale wraith. The anteroom lay, like a small chapel, just off the main entrance hall. It was dimly lit and appeared to be both cooler and slightly quieter than the rest of the house. So I slipped in, sat on a chair, and sipped my wine as one would suck a sour prune. One is always served dry wines at these affairs. I pulled the drapes back and rubbed a fist against the steamed windows. Rain poured down outside, providing neither cool solace nor respite from the humidity. Outside, as inside, people frolicked. In a pool in the courtyard, a number of rather sleek-looking young men and women cavorted like seals or sliding otters. I pressed my face against the fishbowl surface of the window and observed the frenzied activity. Just then, a reflection in a glass pane caught my eye.
Hello, Anna.
Hello, Charles.
She was standing just off the hallway entrance.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, fine. And yourself?
All right.
We paused to consider this and our glasses, which were both nearly empty.
It's quite a party.
Yes, isn't it? A pity about the rain, though.
A real shame.
Mind you, no baseball either.
Oh, yes, yes, there's that.
Is something going on out there?
Huh? Out where?
You had your face pressed against the window.
Oh, there. No, nothing really.
In a second, she was beside me, pushing her face against the window as well. Even with her nose flattened against the glass, one could see she was most attractive.
Oh, looking at the girls in the swimming pool, were you?
Oh, are there girls in the swimming pool? I hadn't noticed. My glasses steam up in this humidity.
Oh, it is humid, isn't it? I wish the rain would go away. Oh, well.
She pushed herself from the window, as I imagine astronauts push themselves from the bulwarks of their craft when they take their strolls in space. She was off.
It's been a hard week, hasn't it?
A very hard week, Charles. I wouldn't repeat it for $1,000,000.
There followed a pause in which I frantically considered what I might say next.
Well, I guess I'll go freshen up my drink.
You know, my doctor says that I'm turning into a fish.
A fish?
Yes. Fish.
Or doctors, you know.
You'd better find a new GP, Charles.
She said, and resubmerged herself slowly into the undulating living room crowd, leaving me once again alone. Why, oh why, I asked myself, did I mention the fish business? Clearly, I'd lost my mind. The anteroom, which had moments ago seemed a haven, now felt cramped and confining. Down the hall and to the left, a circular staircase loomed. With no particular destination in mind, I mounted the stairs. Down a short, dimly lit hallway, a partially open door presented itself to me. I pushed the door gently and entered. From downstairs, I could hear laughter, almost feel it through the soles of my feet. I turned up the lights. By chance, I'd wandered into the master bedroom. For perhaps a minute, I stood perfectly still, looking about. What remained of my glass of wine I drained and set beside a framed photo of Mrs. Purcell on the vanity. My shoes I removed and placed beside those of Mr. Purcell inside and to the right of the walk-in closet door. I proceeded deliberately to the foot of the bed, where I gathered myself together and, in a flurry of motion, launched myself like a rocket into the air. I came down on my belly. It was shaping up to be a fine party when suddenly I heard the toilet flushing in the adjoining bathroom, and before I could alter my position at all, a young man emerged, adjusting his pants. I had no time to get off the bed. I simply looked on, caught. The young man glanced up, surprised, and instantly turned red with embarrassment.
Mr. Purcell,
he asked. I could think of nothing to say, so I nodded.
Sorry to disturb you, sir. I never...
He faltered and moved quickly towards the bedroom door.
Would you prefer the lights off?
Again, it seemed safest just to nod. He turned the lights off and opened the door.
Wonderful party.
He congratulated me as he stepped outside and reclosed the door. As the lock clicked shut, I sat upright on the bed. Again, eerily, the laughter erupted like a geyser from the party below. What a fool I've been, I thought to myself. The young man had obviously mistaken me for Mr. Purcell, and not only had I not disabused him of the notion, but I'd encouraged him with my idiotic nods. My actions had necessitated an immediate departure, I realized, but I'd come by bus, and I had a half hour yet to wait until the next bus arrived. What to do? I straightened the quilt and vacated the room. What I desperately needed now was a quiet sanctuary. I fled down the stairs and up a series of halls. In an area of the house which appeared more tranquil, I opened a door and felt a gust of air simultaneously more humid and somewhat cooler than the rest of the house. I entered and realized I'd discovered Mr. Purcell's newly built indoor garden. A small stream wound in and about a miniature archipelago of weeping figs, Norfolk pine, banana plants, and citrus trees. I passed slowly over a small bridge and proceeded along a red flagstone pathway to a secluded central area where I had thought I might rest and think undisturbed, but where instead I found Anna once again, leaning against a wooden railing, peering into a smallish pool and fountain.
Hello again.
Oh! Jesus, Charles. You startled me.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
No, I'm sure you didn't.
I hope you don't think I've been, well, following you. Are you all right?
Water inside and out.
Pardon?
The rain on the glass roof and the water spilling from the fountain. Water.
She focused her attention upon me once more.
Water everywhere, it seems.
Yes. Yes, I suppose so. It does seem that way, doesn't it?
You do well at these parties, don't you, Charles?
I do.
You seem so wonderfully self-contained, wandering around, interested in everything.
She stopped in mid-sentence and passed a hand over the pond, peering intently at her reflection as she did so.
Is something wrong?
I don't know. This party, like a pane of glass. I can't seem to break into it from any angle. There are no themes anywhere. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I think so.
I've always been able to get through somehow in the past. But tonight, here? I don't know. I don't know, Charles.
In a single pane of glass above, I could see our reflections. And above and beyond that, the inky darkness and the rain coming down.
Don't you ever get tired of it?
What do you mean?
Of trying to talk to different people about the same things. The same useless things.
She plucked a fig leaf from a branch and slowly tore pieces from it, tossing each piece into the pond as she spoke.
Stop pretending to know about subjects you don't know anything about, don't care about, haven't the slightest interest in.
But are supposed to have an interest in.
Yes, that's it. Don't you ever get tired of it?
Yes, yes, of course I do.
You do?
All the time.
What passes for conversation? Oh. Facile observations, trite comments.
The conversation, oh God, the conversation. The endless dissection and discussion of ghost-written autobiographies. The elevation to deityhood of day and nighttime soaps. And, oh, the perpetual deliberation over whoever is the cutting edge of whatever musical revolution is occurring presently, whose manifestation just happens to sound like the musical revolution of 15 years ago, which was then only a pale imitation of something that happened 15 years prior.
Starlet, stars, athletes, TV talk show hosts.
Oh, exactly, exactly.
Oh, I'm so tired of it all.
Me too, me too. I'm so glad, Anna, that you've said what you just said. Oh, I believe and understand everything that we have been talking about. It's such a tremendous relief to hear my own thoughts echoed so precisely. Anna.
How we ended embracing, I don't know. Without speaking, we left hand in hand for the cloakroom where we appropriated our coats, then proceeded through the rain to her car and eventually my apartment. And it's only after some hours, at 3:10 in the morning to be exact, that I'm able to relate this as the truth, for I probably wouldn't have believed it otherwise, but would have thought it more likely to have been a dream, because she is still asleep in the bed beside me. August 30th, afternoon, my living room. I rarely drink, almost never get drunk, so drinking as much as I did, as quickly as I did last night, had an effect on me not unlike peeling back the bone and skin from the top of my head, pouring kerosene directly over the pink, soft flesh of the brain, and setting it alight. Unwilling to risk any sudden movements, I quietly sent one hand to explore the far side of the bed, where it discovered the vacated sheets. The misery of the hangover now combined with the wretched suspicion that I'd been deserted. My apartment, never the most appealing of places, took on a positively Orwellian atmosphere. Not knowing what to do exactly, I decided to act upon the little advice I'd heard concerning the cure of hangovers and go for a walk in the fresh air. Outside, the rain came down as though it meant never to stop. Continuous as a waterfall, it just kept pouring over the edge of the sky. It was while putting on my clothes that I had discovered a surprising further development. I could no longer raise my arms above the level of my shoulders. Having no greater capacity for despair, I matter-of-factly wrote this down to be one of the many debilitating effects of the dreaded hangover. As I followed a path alongside the river, my thoughts returned again to the events of the previous night, about which I had mixed emotions. On the one hand, it had been a marvelous experience, the premier occurrence of my life, possibly. On the other hand, where was she? And why had she left without saying goodbye? Had I offended her in some way? I'd heard of people talking in their sleep and revealing secrets which might offend, but truthfully, I had nothing in my storehouse of experience worthy of such a startling revelation. And perhaps I thought I had talked in my sleep and had bored her. As I walked, these thoughts limping through my mind like lame, dark crows, I noticed on the other side of the river a group of boys diving into the water. This, at first glance, seemed normal enough, and yet what, I wondered, would anyone be doing swimming on a day as cool as this? I turned and hurried along the path, a feeling of deep unease mounting in the pit of my stomach.
I'm quite certain that it doesn't say that.
Matthew 4, verse 19.
I know which verse it is.
As I hastened down the path, I encountered a minister and one of his congregation on their way into service, engaged in what appeared to be a discussion of some particular passion. The parishioner especially seemed distraught.
I know very well which verse it is, but it doesn't say that. I've checked my Bible, and there's an R in there. An R, I tell you.
It's a misprint.
A misprint?
A misprint.
the minister repeated with a voice like oil covering stirred waters, and then they were inside the church, and I could hear no more. What, I thought to myself, could have upset this man so much? I was still turning this over as I passed a sign announcing the day's sermon. There, along the top, was posted in large letters, Matthew 4, verse 19, and beneath it in smaller letters the particular quote. At first I detected nothing wrong. It was only after I had walked a few steps further that the image replayed itself in my mind, and suddenly something seemed askew. Again I turned and examined the piece of scripture, and this time I saw it. Follow me, it said, and I shall make you fishes of men. Not fishers, fishes. This substitution of vowel for consonant filled me with more terror than can be easily explained. Stiff as my legs were, I ran home in record time, and once there, closed the door behind me, locked it, and leaned against it, panting. What was it? What had I seen? What had I seen that was so strange or odd? I could come up with no satisfactory answer. A misprinted sign, a snippet of dialogue, a group of boys out enjoying the water. Had I not been drinking the night before and suffering a dehydrated brain now as a consequence, would there be anything to add drama to this random series of events? I took a deep breath, and then another one. Stood away from the door and ran a hand through my hair. I'd almost succeeded in putting myself completely at ease when I happened to glance down and noticed that my hand had come away with a fistful of hair. August 31st, at work, just prior to going home. After a nightmarish evening spent deliberating over the state of my mental health, I came to work and tried vainly to maintain some small sense of normalcy. It was nearing 9:15 when Anna happened to pass my desk.
Hi, Charles. How are you?
She propped herself up against my section of wall and smiled. I blinked for a few moments, I think.
Where have you been? I've been trying to call you all morning.
I had a meeting with Mr. Purcell. Say, are you all right? Why are you wearing that toque?
I can't tell you right now. Look, can you meet me for lunch?
Sure. The lunchroom at 12?
No, outside. The takeout place down the block.
All right. Something wrong, Charles?
I'll tell you at 12.
Okay.
She turned to go.
Anna.
Yeah?
What happened on...
On Sunday?
Yes, on Sunday.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. I woke up early and realized it was supposed to be at my parents' for brunch. You were asleep and I couldn't wake you. I tried calling later, but you weren't in. I hope I didn't worry you.
No, of course not.
Good. Lunch then?
Right.
She waved and left. Instantly, I was racked with conflicting feelings of embarrassment and relief. My distress and anxiety compared so unfavorably with her calm detachment that I again wondered if my analysis of the situation had been incorrect. This sentiment lingered with me as I worked on at my desk, and yet, everywhere I looked, the situation appeared more and more obvious. When I went to meet Anna for lunch, she was already waiting outside the cafe for me. She handed me a bag lunch she'd purchased.
Let's walk. A nice light rain.
Since Anna and I had last spoken, I had had some opportunity to think things through, and now I was determined to come straight to the point.
Anna?
Mm-hmm?
It'll sound hard to believe, I know, but I must tell you now, as it increasingly becomes obvious to me, that there are great numbers, how many I can't say, but great numbers of our population who are turning into fish.
I anticipated her objections and hurried to explain.
Yes, fish, I say. Now, the mechanics of this transformation, how it began, where it'll end, or indeed what sort of fish shall be arrived at in the end, all this I can't tell you, but of this I'm certain. We are already in the latter stages of the process. Now, it's possible that it works differently with each individual, with some working from inside and only slowly manifesting itself on the outside later, while in others it performs in reverse, displaying the physical characteristics earlier on. This, I believe, has been the case with myself, Anna. Now, I've said we all along because I, along with many others, am most certainly, slowly but irresistibly, becoming a fish.
I removed my woolen cap and displayed my hair, now falling out in great patches. I had expected Anna to be shocked by all I'd said. I half expected her to express outright disbelief. She did none of these things. Instead, she looked at me sympathetically and took my hands in hers.
Try,
she said softly.
Let's look on the bright side of things, Charles.
My face is uncommonly inexpressive, so I don't think it revealed the surprise which these words elicited.
Fish.
She continued in easy tones.
Are gregarious. They have complicated social interactions. Things could be worse. Well, even you must admit that in fish we share the common heritage of our early Silurian era. And how much better looking they are than the rudimentary legged amphibians, our scaly skinned reptiles.
Oh.
In fish, we find the first beginnings of appreciation of art.
Appreciation of art?
Their fascination with bright objects. What? Marbles, tinfoil, metal lures.
Oh.
Here we see the simple enjoyment of things, unencumbered by any intellectual pretense, a simplicity and rectitude of demeanor that I'm sure you, of all people, will grow to appreciate.
I don't think so. I don't like fish. I think I shall never like fish.
Believe me, Charles.
She breathed.
Everything will be all right.
Then she glanced down at her watch.
Oh, I've got to go.
As she walked away, I stood mesmerized, lost in thought of what she'd said, and entranced by the rotations her body took as she walked. A swivel or rolling action that was almost a fish-like ripple. September 22nd, late afternoon, my apartment. The last I saw of Anna, she was doing a slow crawl across the city reservoir. So ended the only relationship I had ever had. I like to believe that the evening we spent together was triggered by mutual admiration. But looking back, I begin to see she must have been transforming inside for some time already, and might only have been reacting to a spawning instinct provoked by the sound of rushing water in Mr. Purcell's fountain. So it is everywhere. We are all turning into fish. In the city itself, there is remarkably little in the way of chaos. There has been some scavenging and pilfering at the pet food stores as people begin packing box lunches for themselves, so to speak, from the fish food stocks on the shelves. Those of us who are left keep the lights on at night. It's friendlier that way. So the city shimmers and twinkles in the rain every evening as each of us in our own solitary way turns into a fish. And fish aren't so very bad when you think about it. Anyone who's tried angling can't deny their innate intelligence, nor can anyone who has seen them struggle upstream to spawn deny their courage. What used to appear to me to be the cruel, toothy maw of a salmon now seems a friendly, wholesome grin. The habit of devouring their young, which at one time horrified me, seen in another light, merely allows the best and the brightest to excel without having to pander to that great leveler, mediocrity. It is, I suppose, not unlike a very strict private school. Indeed, I believe it may be, as a young man put it to me the other day when down at the dam watching the migrations. It won't be so very difficult jumping in when the time comes, he said. I suppose not.
Back feeling a little numb? Things not going swimmingly? Work got you blue about the gills? Don't fight it. Take the leap into that river streaming towards the vanishing point.
The Last 30 Days of Charles L. Danforth by Clem Martini, with Stephen Hare as Charles and Marianne Maroney as Anna and the nurse. You also heard Norris Bick, Eric Tully, and Clem Martini. Technical operations were by Al Lambden and Norm Hurley, with sound effects by Uta Schaflin, and the production assistant was Elaine Farner. Original music was by Lorna McLaughlin. The series script editor is Sandra Rabinovich. The musical theme is by John Roby, and the voice of Vanishing Point is David Calderisi. The Last 30 Days of Charles L. Danforth was produced at CBC Calgary by Greg Rogers. The executive producer of Vanishing Point is William Lane. Until next week, I'm Lorna Jackson, wishing you good night.
This is a gramophone. Before the days of metric, it was called an ounceophone. This is a microphone. Before the days of chip technology, it was called a macrophone. Excuse me. I have to get the phoneme.